Canova, And what he is doing is, for 30 years, he's traveled extensively all over the world researching about mainstream and alternative religious and spiritual studies, along with quantum physics, and he is considered one of America's foremost authorities on the secret teachings of the Gnostic Gospels and of the sacred feminine. And he is also an acclaimed author of the newly released spiritual thriller. Yes, who'd have thought you could put those two together, spiritual thriller, Pope Annalisa. And this book is the winner of 9 awards, including the Nautilus Gold Award for Visionary Fiction, that has been formally bestowed on such authors as Eckhart Tolle, Deepak Chopra, and the Dalai Lama. Well, guess what? The executive producers of the Academy Award-winning movie Black Swan have signed a deal with Peter to produce a film adaptation of this book called Pope Annalisa. And Peter is a nationally sought-after and dynamic speaker who was recently featured as a presenter at the internationally acclaimed Gate 2 event on February 4th of 2012, earlier this year. And it's for the Global Alliance for Transformational Entertainment, GATE, and was founded by Eckhart Tolle and Jim Carrey and John Ratz. And he was an invited speaker at the Unity Church's annual national conference in Detroit this June. And you can visit Peter's website, www.popeannalisa.com, for additional information and in-depth other materials. Well, let's bring him on and have some fun. Welcome, Peter.
Oh, thank you, Ken. After that glowing introduction, I'm wondering if I should pack my bags and go home right now.
No, just to take a look in a mirror and go, geez, that's a fascinating guy. Wow. What the heck has he been up to? Well, to find out more about that, in your book, for instance, as we get started, you speak about ancient mystery schools as ones that are repositories of a universal spiritual tradition once common to different levels, different cultures of the ancient world. Can you talk about these schools?
Sure. Well, there are, in my studies, I found what I believe to be a universal spiritual tradition, and the threads of which really permeated all cultures and all lands at all times throughout history. And the origin of this tradition probably is buried in the mist of time, 12,000 BC or earlier, starting with shamanism, which is, essentially the belief that we exist in two worlds side by side. There's the world of the seen, and there's the world of the unseen, or the spirit world. And the shamans were those who walked between those worlds, and they would bring back information, usually, to guide people and to help them in their progress through the material world. But as it came down through the ages, this spiritual wisdom was being taught and being kept alive in what was known as the mystery schools. And the mystery schools, you can almost think of them like an Ivy League network of learning and teaching academies that spread from India all the way to the British Isles. And they were basically the repositories of this spiritual wisdom. They kept the flame of light and illumination alive throughout the centuries so that this knowledge would not be lost to humankind. And some of the more famous schools that we know of were in the Hermetic school in Egypt, the Pythagorean school, the Greek Pythagorean school in Italy, and the Eleusinian mysteries. These are all really variations and themes of the different mystery traditions. And they really, you could really boil it down to a number of common teachings, but I'll concentrate on the four major ones. The first thing is that everything that exists is part of one consciousness or one energy, that what they call God or the first or the forethought or the first father, which are were ancient terms for consciousness, is the basis for everything that exists. And all the multiplicity that we see in the world really boils down to this one energy at the very fundamental level. The second principle would have been that this consciousness expresses itself through the vehicle of light. And by light, we mean an organic light that contained intelligence. And they're finding now in quantum physics that light most definitely does carry information in it, that light is very much involved in the creation of matter itself, causing the various spins of subatomic particles, which create the electrical charges that allow atoms to cohere and then to form molecules and so forth in very specific ways. So that light most definitely does contain intelligence because it discerns. It spins these atoms in a certain way to form certain things so that you end up with a dog as distinct from a cat. Hmm. And so you see, the light shows discernment, and it shows information, it displays information, and those are hallmarks of consciousness. So light was the vehicle by which this consciousness would spread itself throughout creation. And then the two other main principles were that the one energy manifested itself in the detectable world in two polar forces, which were called God the Father and God the Mother, the yin, the yang, the male, the female. And from this duality preceded the multiplicity of everything we know. So it was kind of like a continuous wave of a creation stemming from the one to the two and then to the whole multiple appearances of everything that we know in the universe, including us as human beings. And those were the common threads of the ancient mystery school teachings that they were imparting secretly, privately, to select candidates who would have to undergo scrutiny and kind of like entrance exams, in effect, to make sure that they were mature enough, spiritually mature enough, in order to receive these sacred teachings.
Wow. Wow. That's phenomenal. All of these, everything coming from these common roots, and you just to bringing it forward. Now, I'm just kind of wondering, in addition to this, as we've seen things come forward from this, I don't know if there's any simplistic distillation of these spiritual traditions, you know, as you talk about these four things, or as we think about, for instance, Christianity, Judaism, the Muslim faith, how those things came and blossomed forth from this.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, in fact, each of those religions, the three Abrahamic religions that you just mentioned, they had a mystical core to them. And in Judaism, of course, it's the famous Kabbalah. In Christianity, it was Gnosticism. And Islam, it was the Sufis or Sufism. And each of these mystical cores of these religions would espouse similar teachings to what I just described to you, because they were direct descendants from the mystery school. Now, what happens over time, and so often is the case, is that the number of people who were able to really comprehend and embrace the mystery teachings is always going to be fewer than the masses outside who really don't have the time or the inclination in order to get into the higher mysteries. And so what happens is that those people end up going to the outer expressions of those religions, which would be Orthodox Christianity, Orthodox Judaism, and Orthodox Islam. So you have a dichotomy there where you have the inner kernel of these religions that was mystical, but the outer expressions of the shells were rather very literal, actually. And that's where most of the problems usually start, because Islam and Sufism and the Kabbalah and Gnosticism have more in common with one another than they have with their outer religions. Their outer religions, of course, are the ones that take things very literally, and that usually leads to various agendas and interpretations, and you end up with conflicts between these religions because they always think that their interpretation or their God is superior to the one of the other religions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, this contest of who's got the best God has been going on for a while.
Yeah, I got a feeling God's really laughing at that one, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I hope thanks to the work you're doing, that people can stand back from this long enough to go, well, I tell you, given the peril on the planet, maybe we can suspend the competition for the best God long enough to make sure we still have a playing field to have the contest on.
I do think that things are changing because, you know, there were some articles that actually, I think it was the cover of Newsweek magazine some years ago, that gleefully proclaimed that that religion is dying and that religion is dead or dying in America. Of course, you know, being a secular publication, they seem to take a great deal of comfort in this. But I think if you really read between the lines, yes, religion per se is dwindling, but spirituality is increasing on the other side of the scale. And what that means to me is that people are taking a less restrictive view of God and of religious things or spiritual things, and they're encompassing a broader type of spirituality that is more inclined to recognize the unity of the real foundation of our universe, as the Kabbalah does, as Sufism does, as Gnosticism, you know, does. So that although religion, formal religion, traditional religion may be shrinking on one side, it doesn't mean that people are flocking to becoming atheists. They're seeking expression in different forms.
Ah, well, that's certainly refreshing and encouraging. Now, this thing that you made mention of this dichotomy that's come forward, of this idea of the good and evil, and can you talk a little bit about the role of evil in the traditional view that we have gotten down the years?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, in traditional religion, and let's talk about the Judeo-Christian tradition, which is the one that's nearest to us, like everything else in that tradition, everything gets externalized and separated, and so you have this apparent, you know, dichotomy of good versus evil. But the ancient tradition would really not have looked at it that way. In fact, they probably wouldn't have even used the term evil per se. The conception is that, you see, and it gets back to a deeper issue. It gets back to the very roots of creation itself. And so maybe in order to answer the question of good and evil, let's step back a couple chapters and talk about the creation for a second in the view of Orthodox Judeo-Christianity and the view of the ancient spiritual tradition. In Orthodox Judeo-Christianity, humans were a separate creation. They were kind of a lump of clay, and God breathed life into them, and then they sinned somehow, and now, you know, we're running around this earthly insane asylum trying to get back in God's good graces. And God, by the way, is this kind of stern, judgmental God that sits up there on a throne in the sky somewhere, like a Roman emperor who dispenses justice for doing good, and, you know, or for, you know, punishment for doing bad. And that was all of the traditional Judeo-Christian concept, and it was a very externalized concept of the deity, and there was a definite gulf and separation between the divine and humanity. Now, the ancient spiritual tradition was very different. They said there was no separation between the divine and humanity, that in fact the divine essentially flowed out its consciousness into everything that we see in the universe today, and that the human being is essentially a material expression, a material vessel of this divine consciousness. And the thing is, why don't we remember that? Okay, if that's really true, why do most people not feel so godlike? Why do most people not feel so divine? Well, the answer to that is this, and this gets a little difficult to understand, so I'm going to try and be as graphic as I can about it. But if the divine, if there is one energy and one energy only in reality, and the divine encompasses everything, how can something that is everything contain anything that is something? How can it have something that is distinct and separate from it? If it encompasses everything, there can really be no separation, right?
Yeah.
So what the ancients said about that was that, look, the divine actually had to withdraw or contract into itself and essentially leave a void space wherein it could project portions of itself that forgot that they were part of the whole. And they had to forget that they were part of the whole as a necessity for being able to have experience as individuals. So in order to have individual experience, the very prerequisite of that is you have to have a certain amount of ignorance or shadow that goes along with that consciousness, because if we had the consciousness of the whole, we wouldn't think of ourselves as the parts. We would be the whole. We'd be part of the whole flow. But to think of myself as Peter or you as Ken or us as individuals, we have to have a certain level of ignorance or forgetfulness in us that we are part of the whole in order to have the illusion of separate experience. So evil stems directly from this, because we are creatures of light and shadow. We contain portions of the divine within us, but we also have this ignorance within us that allows us to feel that we are separate individuals. That shadow has various degrees. When you reach extreme degrees of the illusion of separation, that's when it shades into what people call evil, because you're so separated from any idea of being part of a unity that you can do harm to other people or other things and think that there's no consequence to it because you're totally separate from them. They're totally separate from you. They're beneath you. They're lowly. They're something that deserves to be killed, whatever, or harmed, whatever. You don't really care because there's no connection between you and them. So evil is really a matter of ignorance, and it's these degrees of shadow or separation that we have within us. And enlightenment is just the opposite of that process of shadow. Enlightenment is ascending back up to our source and enlightening ourselves, getting more light and decreasing the shadow in our lives. And that's when we start to become closer to the source and we start to recognize that, in fact, we really and truly are all one and the same at the deepest levels.
Mm. Wow. That certainly is something that I'd love to see spreading more, and I guess is that some of the theme that you've ended up wanting to create in the movie Pope Annalisa?
Oh yeah, most definitely. I mean, all these things we're talking about are very much form the thematic underpinning of the book and the movie. Yeah.
Oh, geez. Now, can you help explain them? Because this is such useful information. Is there some particular reason or reasons that much of this has been suppressed or not taught?
Well, yeah, I mean, the link that we had in Christianity to this wisdom information were the Gnostic Christians. And essentially, in the early days of Christianity, there were two streams of Christianity. There was the outer or Orthodox Church, and then was the inner or mystical Church, and that was the Gnostic Church. And what happened was that let me get back and make an important point here. How do we know that this was the case? Even in the Bible, you have Jesus repeatedly saying unto the disciples, and this is in all the Synoptic Gospels, that unto those that are without, these things are done in parables, but to you are given the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Well, essentially what he was saying is that, for those people who are ready, for those people who are mature enough, we're really giving the teachings that lead to enlightenment here, but not everybody is capable of doing that. Not the masses out there, the kind of, ignorant masses, especially in those days, who are largely uneducated, were not really capable of absorbing these things. So they were giving teachings at the level that they could understand. Now, that the public church became the literal Orthodox dogmatic church. And the mystical church, which was mainly headed by the females, especially Mary Magdalene, was going along on a parallel course. But when the Roman Empire started to persecute the Christians, the Orthodox developed a strategy, and they said, look, the best way to beat them is to join them. So let's get accepted as the official religion by the Roman Empire, and we can, avoid the persecutions. And in order to do that, they had to get rid of the female component of the church, which was largely the mystical church, and all that mumbo-jumbo they didn't understand because it became an embarrassment to them. You have to remember that back in those days in particular, these societies were very patriarchal. Judea and Rome mm-hmm. and Greece. These were highly patriarchal societies. So in order to compete with all these other religions vying for official status of the Roman Empire, you couldn't really have so many women and you know, this kind of teaching at the helm of your helm of your movement there. So they gradually started moving the women aside, and they gradually started suppressing the secret teachings. And it culminated when in 325, Emperor Constantine found a real use for the Orthodox Christian interpretation in order to use it as kind of a creed or a dogma to unify his empire, which was fragmenting politically. So he got these male bishops in a room, whole cast of male bishops, and he said, listen, you're going to define what it means to be a Christian, and from now on, everybody's got to toe that line, because if they don't, there's going to be consequences. So they came up with the Nicene Creed, I believe in one God, Father Almighty, and you know, much of the other early theology of the church and the dogma of the church. And from that point on, what had once been a real varied form of Christianity from different communities all throughout the world, now you sort of, you know, had to all fall into line in one way and one belief. And that was what really spelled the doom of the mystical church, because over the centuries, their writings were burnt and suppressed, and even the mystics themselves were exterminated.
Ooh. Wow. So back to, I guess, what would be a good form of wanting to, as Constantine was thinking, okay, I've got this large empire to manage. What's my best path to controlling this thing? And the choice that he came up with was this one of the defining Christianity and getting people to toe a line that was put together. Was this the Nicene Council that you were talking about? Or?
Yeah, that was Nicaea was the first attempt at defining the creed of the Orthodox Christian Church. And, you know, Constantine was a pretty shrewd guy. I mean, what better way to snap people to attention than by, you know, putting God behind you? And so this is what he attempted to do. He was mixing religion and politics, essentially. And, of course, the character of the church changed dramatically once it came under the influence of the Roman emperors.
Wow. Now, so here's this going on that is kind of dominated on Earth for a good amount of time, and then your research into quantum physics, which has been a big part of your background. I'm wondering, can you shine a little bit of light on some of these things? Parables between ancient mystical traditions and quantum physics.
Yeah, well, you know, you talk about these ancient texts, which are pretty complex, and then you talk about quantum physics, which could blow your mind. These are kind of difficult concepts to explain. But yeah, I mean, the one thing certainly is that quantum physics is definitely moving towards a conception that one energy underlies the entire universe. Now, they won't, because there's a lot of scientists out there, and because you have a dichotomy in science. You have traditional materialistic science, and you have, you know, the more avant-garde discoveries in sciences like quantum physics. And the avant-garde discoveries are leading us to the fact that the ancients were right. There is one energy and one energy only underlying the universe. And a lot of scientists won't admit that consciousness is part of that energy. They just call it an energy without using the word consciousness. But in the quantum world, they've found a lot of evidence of intelligence in the quantum world. I cited some examples earlier in this conversation where I described how information and intelligence are transmitted in the very photons of light itself. That comprises the light of this world, and that how that has to do with the creation of matter and instructing matter in such a way that it forms the different multiplicity of forms that we see around us, so that we know that it's not only intelligent, but it's also informative. And, you know, you can see it in so many things that the ancients said. I'll give you a very good example, a rather stunning example that's just happened very recently. You may have read about the Higgs boson particle.
Ah, yes.
God particle. Yeah, well, basically what happens with the Higgs boson particle, and really the real play here is not so much the Higgs boson particle or the Higgs particle, it's the Higgs field. The Higgs bosons are contained within a field called the Higgs field. And the Higgs field is an invisible energy field that permeates all of space, all of the universe. And you can think of it, best way to think of the action of the Higgs field is like imagine a big aquarium or a fish tank or a swimming pool, that the water in there is continuous, there's no holes, and it fills up everything that, you know, it takes up all that space and it fills it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you have currents of energy that flow through this field, kind of like fish swimming through water. Now, in some cases, you have a real streamlined fish like a barracuda, and it zips through pretty quickly. In other cases, you have a big ponderous fish like a hammerhead shark, and it moves slower because it encounters more drag.
Mm-hmm.
So these energies enter into the Higgs field, and they have different coefficients of drag. So some of them will be slowed just a little bit, and some of them will be slowed a lot. The very act of energy coming to a halt or slowing to a more restful state is what creates mass, because mass essentially is a crystallized form of energy slowed down to a slower vibration. And it's the Higgs field, it's the action of the Higgs field that takes these energies, which sometimes act like particles and sometimes act like waves, but whatever you call them, it slows them down, and in the act of slowing, they acquire mass. And this is what forms the particles that we talk about, the basic building blocks of matter that go on to form the atoms and then the molecules and then the elements and then the different forms of gross material matter that we perceive. So the Higgs field is like the gateway to between the energetic and the material world. It's where energy starts to coalesce and become solid matter. Couple interesting things here. Number one, the ancients talked about ether. And the etheric world essentially was described just like the Higgs field. It's something that it's a medium that encompasses everything. And everything that we see that exists comes from this energetic field. And essentially, that was an ancient description of the Higgs field. The other stunning thing is that in the Gnostic Gospels, they have a central myth of a divine being named Sophia, which is the wisdom of God, and that Sophia is a female figure. And Sophia leaves the divine bright vibration, and she goes into another dimension. And essentially, her energy, her highly vibrating divine energy, gets slowed down in this other dimension. It described these elements like Higgs bosons essentially flock to her, swarm to her like iron filings would swarm over a magnet, and slowed her vibration down. And it was her slowed vibration of her divine energy that essentially ultimately led to the creation of matter. Well, that whole story of Sophia, her divine energy slowing down in this other dimensional field, is a complete description of the Higgs particle in non-technical terms, because they didn't have particle colliders back then.
Right. Wow. Oh, my gosh. This is fabulous. So that science at the highest levels of its studies now is confirming some of the things that were part of the ancient mystical teachings.
Well, yes, it is. And you know, it's creating, it's going to create an interesting dynamic, because the Western world is caught between a rock and a hard place. We've been caught between traditional dogmatic religion on one hand and traditional dogmatic materialistic science on the other hand. And materialistic science stemmed from, the 17th, 18th, and 19th century discoveries with Newton, Descartes, and Darwin, which seemed to create a mechanistic view of the world, and that you could, especially with Darwinism, you could sort of explain life without the presence of any intelligence. Well, you know, that whole thing, particularly Darwinism, is completely full of holes. Darwinism isn't even really a science. It was an ideology or a philosophy based on the notes of one individual named Charles Darwin and his observations, and it was jumped upon by people who were dying to get out from under the yoke of the church, which had controlled life and put so many strictures on life for so long. So in their haste to break the shackles of the church, they latched on to a very specious kind of science here, a bogus kind of science that has so many holes in it that's probably too many to mention on this show, and it's a bankrupt model. But it's the model that is still used in the scientific materialist world because people are invested in it. They have their reputations invested in it. They have, you know, a body of work over the last century that's invested in it, and people are very slow to give up on their sacred cows. So you have a certain branch of science or certain scientists that probably in their own hearts they really know that this is a lot of baloney, but they're clinging to it because, you know, that's it, and I'm going to go with it right or wrong. But then you have the evidence and the weight of the new sciences coming in, which is now skipping over religion and joining hands with these thousands of years old ancient mystical traditions, and together they're walking down the road of the future to show us a whole new paradigm about our reality.
Oh, my gosh. Well, and it's interesting because when you mentioned about Darwinism and how it was used as a way for people to rally and gain some freedom from the dictatorial practices of the church, it's sort of like I can understand why they'd want to hold on to it, because without having somewhere else to turn, relinquishing that just puts them back under the control of the church.
Exactly. And you see, if you look at, it's very interesting, if you look at quotations from some of the leading atheistic scientists, people like Richard Dawkins and so forth, you know, it's like they'll acknowledge, and I have quotes from famous materialist scientists that acknowledge that Darwinism makes no sense, but you know what, we're not going to give it up, because if we do, then the divine gets a foot back in the door, the church gets a foot back in the door. So they're so afraid of religion making a comeback that they'll go with something that even doesn't make sense on the other hand. So, you know, it's too bad it happened that way, because essentially they threw the baby out with the bathwater. There was a path of liberation, but it wasn't known to them at the time, and that is that if you look at the ancient spiritual wisdom, it didn't have anything to do with religion, traditional religion that we have today. It was a deep spiritual wisdom that was actually destroyed by traditional religion, or nearly destroyed by traditional religion. And these people could have taken a more broader spiritual interpretation, which would have been compatible with the findings of new science. But now they've locked themselves into a position, and it's sort of like they feel like, well, you know, we got the genie back in the lamp, and, you know, we got to sit on it, because if we don't, it's going to get back out again.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So that's one of the reasons to defend it. But what I'd like you to help us to discover through your work and through the movie, there's a path, because as you see, in the world, the place is a big mess. The injustice, the inequality, the insanity is off the chart. And when we talk in terms of human potential, we see how these things have just stepped on it. Like a bug on the windshield of life. Can you talk about how we can make some breakthroughs, getting past traditional religion and materialistic science through the path that you're elaborating on?
Well, I think that, you see, everything starts with the individual, and there's no mass prescription to solve humanity's ills. The only way to solve the ills of humanity is by each of us raising our level of consciousness, and that means we each have to take spiritual responsibility for ourselves. And there's many paths to doing that. My path was one way, yours is another. There's as many paths as there are people, but ultimately you will find that they kind of lead to the same doorstep. And, you know, for some people it starts off as just reading and listening to shows like yours, and you work with the intellectual aspect, and then eventually you have to graduate beyond that to something more intuitive and something more subjective, which happens in a meditative practice or some other contemplative practice. So you combine your intellectual knowledge with a cultivation of your intuition, and it's really the two of those, it's the heart and the mind, the right and the left brain, the male and the female working together. As Jesus said in the Gnostic Gospels, when you make the male as the female and the female as the male and the two become one, then you really move mountains. And what he meant by that was that we have to take all of the innate faculties within us, the right brain and the left brain, and bring them into an operating symmetry. And it's kind of like a rocket. Okay, a rocket has two components. You have the fuel, which is the sort of heartfelt female intuition, and you have the guidance system, which is sort of the rational, linear thinking, male-directed analysis. And without the fuel, you never get off the ground. Without the guidance system, you get off the ground, but you're just going to go around in circles. So you need the both of them working together. And however that manifests in your life, that's really the course of your life, but you need to incorporate those factors within whatever path that you take.
Wow. Wow. So, I love it. This is such an interesting breakthrough, because the essence that I'm getting from some of what you're saying is that mankind for a long, long time has been kept separate from God and therefore beholding to this invisible energy that was there as this dominant figure that needed to be pleased. And so here were the humbled masses that had so much in common of what can we do. And now you're talking about, well, when we start to get connected to this, that we can never be separate from God, then it puts us back on that path of, okay, now what do each of us do as an individual? And this is a radical approach, and of course very freeing, but my gosh, I'm just excited. Does the movie Pope Annalisa help bridge that gap for people?
Well, you know, we're still formulating the movie now. We're in the very early stages of kind of polishing the script, so we won't be seeing the movie for a bit yet, but the book certainly does.
Okay.
And, the book, and you know, really shows kind of the story of how these principles could evolve through the lives of real people. And it's not a boring kind of intellectual or scholarly discussion, maybe a little bit like scholarly like we're having here. But it's a real thriller. It's a real page turner. And it shows these principles in action. And I think, you know, for most people in the Western world, it's going to start on the intellectual level, because that's where most people are in the Western world. They're kind of in that sort of left brain intellectual side. And that would be to read material, to listen to shows like this, to read material, to read spiritual text, to read some more popular books on quantum physics. But at the end of the day, you really do have to incorporate that intuitive side to actually contact this higher source of information directly. Now, the minority of people, and these are the ones who probably would have been more like the ones that were accepted in the mystery schools back in the old days, the minority of people are born with more of a psychic inclination. So rather than arriving at this material intellectually, they actually have an intuitive or a psychic or a Gnostic experience. That would have been, my experience was more from that side than it was from the book learning side. The book learning side really came later on as an effort to understand the psychic or intuitive experiences that I was having.
Ah, can you share a little bit about that? And I don't know if those were early in your life or if they've been with you throughout your life. And can you share anything specific? Because that may help myself and the listeners to connect to a little bit of that within themselves.
Well, I guess I didn't have any indications of these things, when I was young per se, but I always had a restlessness. I always had something kicking at the back of my mind saying, there's something else out there. There's something more to this world than what it seems. This world isn't right. There's some other something else out there. This world isn't what it really seems. And so I always felt this sense of alienation. And so I guess it led me to find a group that was actually teaching people how to enhance their higher perception, back in those days called EST. And about a week into this, I found out that I was an accurate medical intuitive. So by just giving me somebody's name, age, and address, and I remember the very first case I did, I saw there was an elderly gentleman in Miami, and I saw something wrong with his heart, and it looked like it was tilted at a funny angle and blocking off the aorta. So I said, I think he has a blockage in the aorta, and they said, that's correct. And I saw something that looked like it didn't belong there, and I said, I think he had a pacemaker installed. There's something there. And they said, that's correct. Can you tell us what year the pacemaker was installed? So I saw the hands of a clock spinning wildly, and they stopped at 10 o'clock, which in my mind meant 10 years. And so it was 1975, and I said, I believe he had the pacemaker installed in 65. And they said, that's correct. Well, once I got over the disbelief of what I was doing, and the rational part of my mind trying to squelch what the intuitive part of my mind had just revealed, it opened up a floodgate, and I started having all kinds of phenomena happen to me: remote viewing, clairvoyance, clairaudience, psychometry, you know, just a whole slew of things, and it changed the course of my life, because these things that we normally read about with tongue-in-cheek, I now knew to be totally real because they were happening to me every day. So I graduated from faith in these things to knowledge, because knowledge is gained by direct experience, and that's what I had had. I had direct experience with this higher source of information.
Wow. Oh, Peter, that is just absolutely fabulous, because to me it's not only about you as a researcher and you as an incredibly gifted author of this beautiful work, Profana Lisa, but you on your own journey of connecting to that part of yourself. What do you think the chances that those talents are available to others among us?
Well, I think they're available to everybody among us. I can't guarantee that everybody has a talent for writing or communication, but in terms of contacting the source of information that we've been talking about, this is, remember, we're all connected, you know, at one level. So all of the information, anything that was available to me, is available to somebody else. And it really, a lot depends on your desire. If you have a real burning desire to realize these things, and especially if you couple that with the desire to help people, I mean, that seems to be a key to really unlocking it. If you're doing this not just for yourself, but you're doing this to learn and then to communicate your learning to other people, that intention seems to have a lot to do with unlocking these experiences.
Ah, wow, I love that. Now, one of the things that, and I know this may seem a little bit off track, but a famous book by Ayn Rand about Atlas Shrugged,
yeah,
certainly goes into a lot of detail about the importance of what I would call a healthy self-interest.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that there's might be some similarities or some of that coming forth in the book Profana Lisa.
Well, you know, you're very astute to pick up on that. Very few people pick up on that. And I am familiar with Ayn Rand. There's a lot of things in her philosophy that I'm not necessarily in harmony with, but there's a lot that is. And I will tell you something. It's not a subject I often get into. I don't often get into political discussions and things of that sort. But as I travel in metaphysical circles, people seem to sort of equate this idea of, okay, well, you know, we're all part of an underlying unity. And as they translate that, or as they try to translate that into human institutions, like political institutions and things like that, it ends up being almost like this kind of quasi-fuzzy form of socialism. And I don't think that's what it's about. I think that kind of gets off the track. In fact, I think that's antithetical to what I see spirituality leading to, because I see spirituality leading to liberation. And I see that these human institutions that purport to work for the whole, like socialism, are anything but that. It all, when you say there shouldn't be any high and there shouldn't be any low, people should all be kind of in this gray area in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that stifles the human spirit. People should be encouraged to express themselves. And people say, well, yeah, but if they do that, then they're expressing their individual selves at the expense of other people. But that's not really true, because if you do it with a spiritual consciousness, you see, the highest form of morality and the highest form of consciousness is that when you recognize these spiritual principles and you put them to work in your life and you're able to express yourself, wealth and riches and other things like that are ancillary. They come along, because when you're doing something you're happy with and you're doing something that is fulfilling to you, you know, the money and things like that will attract itself. And once you've done well in life, if you have that kind of consciousness, the first thing you think of is, how can I give back? You see, and that is the highest form of morality or consciousness. It's not a very high form of consciousness for a government to dictate that everybody's got to be equal. Because one thing about these utopian types of governments is somebody always comes and fills that vacuum at the top. some power elite always comes and they become the ruling clique. So every single country that you look at that's gone through these social experiments where they say everybody's got to be equal, it never happens that way. What you have is a mass of people who are restricted, their human potential is restricted, and then you have the ruling elites on top of them. So, you know, what I'm saying is that I think people ought to be careful when they're trying to translate their spiritual experience into human institutions and governments and politics and things of that sort, because it's very simplistic to think that this whole idea of us being a unity means that everybody, in terms of a political or economic sense, must be exactly the same. That's not the way it is. That's really the road to slavery more than it is to liberation.
Wow, I love it. It's so interesting when I'm thinking about this. Historically, when I was going through school, there was different forms of government, and of course, one form that we've seen, like in different ways, is the form of dictatorship or fascism, the totalitarian ruler that basically controls things with no concern for lots of people well-being, but just satisfying their own needs in a small group around them. And I came to this little higher place where it was. Term was called a benevolent monarch, where yes, there was someone running things, but darned if they didn't have a conscience and tried to do things that were fair so that people had needs met and there were still incentives involved for others to excel. And to me, what is exciting is I'm hearing you, it's like taking these things to the next level in the work that you're proposing, to where it's not just relying upon some kindness, some greatness that is a leader. It's like finding that kindness and greatness within each other and then using that as the way to naturally blossom and then be able to support others in the process.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Wow, I love it. people are going to be wanting your book. How can we find that?
Yeah, well, the best thing to do is, a couple things. You can go to Amazon.com, and there's almost 50 reviews on the book, and I would encourage people to go take a look at those. They can get an idea of what other people have thought about the book, and you could either buy it off Amazon or my website. You can buy it directly off my website, discounted, and that's PopeAnnalisa.com, PopeAnnalisa.com. I'm also a columnist on a big internet-faced site called Patheos. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
No, what is it?
Patheos, P-A-T-H-E-O-S. It's a fantastic site, and they have writers from all different religious traditions who contribute to this site. They do blogs, they do columns. I am a columnist for their newest venture, which is the spirituality segment of Patheos. And if you go onto Patheos and you look up blogs and columns, you look up Peter Canova, I'll be there. I think my first two columns are already in there. They just recently started this. But Patheos has been going for a while. They have a huge readership. I think it's up to 500,000 or more now. And anyway, it's a terrific site, and it's very rewarding because there's a lot of other good articles on different types of traditions there, which is a great resource for people.
Wow, this is fabulous. I would definitely want to take a look at that. And then just to, I don't know if there's a bit of a kind of a summary, I mean, with your amazing background and now coming forth with this book that's on its way to becoming a movie, and all your writing and speaking, can you share a little bit about what your personal goals might be in all of this if your dreams come true?
Well, my personal goal is really to impart what I have learned and what I have experienced in ways that I can help other people get to where they want to be in their own practice. And, you know, nobody can completely follow my footsteps or anybody else's footsteps. We're all unique. But I think that what I really try and do is provide a framework for people, and I try and provide the framework on the scientific side, and I try and provide it on the spiritual side. And I try to help people connect the dots and get a couple light bulb moments there with concepts that really hit them and move them in a direction that says, wow, I really want to learn more. So, you know, if I could move somebody off square one to square two, then I feel I've accomplished my goal. That's what I want to do. But they have to really follow their own path, because all my work can be is a signpost, but you can't mistake the signpost for the destination. The destination is their own. Their path is their own. All I can do is give a little bit of a roadmap along the way to help guide, and that's kind of what my work is about.
Wow, this is wonderful. And to me, not only having the book, but with a movie deal with the folks that did Academy Award-winning movie Black Swan, I mean, this is in the very top-level professional hands, which gives a chance for something fanciful and yet deeply meaningful to reach a large number of people. And when that happens, there's typically a following, people talking about it, getting involved in it. And to me, this looks like a vehicle for many people to rally around and embrace some of these ancient teachings without having to go to ancient mystery schools to get interested, that you would be a pathway to that.
I think that, Pope Annalisa, this is my innate sense, and this has nothing to do with me. It's not an ego thing, but my innate sense of Pope Annalisa is that it has the potential for really being a cross-cultural phenomenon, one of those things that can engage people from all walks of life, not just metaphysically oriented people or spiritual or religious people, but your everyday person that doesn't even really think about these matters, that this is something that can get them thinking in a different direction. And, you know, it's a consciousness-raising phenomenon that once you get a critical mass of enough people that understand this, that open their minds to it, then, you know, it spreads like wildfire. It's like the 100 monkeys.
Yeah.
And it just kind of permeates, and it gets into the human bloodstream. Just the concept, I believe, of seeing a female pope will enable that event to actually happen sometime down the road, because the thought form gets ingrained in the society at large. And once it gets ingrained in the society at large, it means that the society at large has accepted the notion of it. Once they've accepted the believability of it, it will happen.
Wow. To me, as we wrap up, we've gone through our time today, but what a place to complete with the feminine that gives birth, and you helping to give birth to the rise of the feminine in your work. Peter, thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show and taking time to be with us.
My pleasure.
And to you, Peter, and to beloved listeners, God bless, and goodbye for now. Let go.